max discharge date.
By the number of days commensurate with the number of days of incarceration?
Yes.
Okay.
So what was shortened? His parole, so he can not be under supervision as long, right?
Correct.
I have a, before you proceed, I had a question. It's hard to tell from these briefs, and I have not read the record. But when should the days that he was in confinement, jail or prison, when should those days have been credited to him? As I understand the briefs, there was an error made by not crediting him at an earlier stage. And then it was discovered, and now we're at this later stage, and the decision has to be made whether to credit it towards the confinement period or the supervision period, right?
Right.
Okay. So originally, when should it have been made?
I'm sorry. Originally, he was placed on probation on this count. On other counts in the case, he did have jail terms. Actually, I think it was a prison term. And so a 12-year term of probation was imposed. The probation was subsequently revoked, and he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. It's at that sentencing after revocation of probation date that the credit should have been granted.
What date is that?
That was in 2001.
So he was sentenced in 2001?
Yes.
And at that time in 2001, how many days was he due in your calculations? Is that the 106?
107. Actually, it was a larger figure, and he was granted some credit, just not all.
Mm-hmm.
So the 107 days were not granted at that point.
Okay.
Do you think the term sentence has any special meaning in 973-155? It calls for a court to give credit toward a sentence.
Correct. And I think that term sometimes can be have different meaning in different contexts. And within the sentence credit statute, I think it's clear that it's referring to confinement. Because subsection C says that credit should be applied as if the person had served the time in the correctional institution.
Now, this is before truth in sentencing, and it's indeterminate.
Yes.
And he's going to gain nothing.
I'm sorry?
He's not going to gain anything by giving the credit to his confinement because he's already served his confinement.
That's right.
And what happens? Does he get a longer probation period?
No,
his succeed.
There's no practical effect on him if I succeed. One thing to note is, of course, the Court of Appeals decision is published, and it was without the benefit of adversary counsel on both sides. Mr. Obright was pro se. Mm-hmm. Also, the language in the extended supervision statute mirrors the term entire period of time in the MR statute. So there is a likelihood that the Court of Appeals decision will affect a lot of people, not just people under indeterminate sentences.
And where is this? What statute are we talking about that you say it's the same?
It is 302.1139B.
And that's under truth in sentencing, extended supervision?
Yes. Another subsection that's quite important from the sentence credit statute is that subsection 5, which provides for application of rightfully earned sentence credit at any time. There's no use it or lose it time limit. So under especially subsections 3 and 5, which are well-established principles, sentence credit must be applied to a period of confinement unless there's no confinement left. There's no special set of rules for revoked parolees. For its conclusion otherwise, the Court of Appeals relied on subsection 7B of the Mandatory Release Statute, 302.11. This subsection is not on point. Section 302.11 involves mandatory release. Subsection 7 is actually an exception to the rule. Each inmate is entitled to mandatory release at two-thirds of the sentence, except subsection 7 provides for revoked parolees. First, the second subsection of sub 7, AM, provides that the reviewing authority, here the DHA, may return a parolee to prison for up to the remainder of the sentence for a violation of parole. In this subsection, the legislature specifically incorporated the sentence credit statute. It states, the remainder of the sentence is the entire sentence less time served in custody prior to parole. The revocation order shall provide the parolee with credit in accordance with 304.072 and 973.155. The next subsection, 7B, is at the crux of the Court of Appeals decision. It states that a revoked parolee shall be incarcerated for the entire period of time determined by the reviewing authority, unless paroled earlier under paragraph C. The parolee is not subject to mandatory release or presumptive mandatory release. Subsection C concerns discretionary parole. The Court of Appeals picked a single sentence in subsection B, entire period of time, and determined that it meant that sentence credit principles do not apply. This conclusion was reached by ignoring context and the meaning of the statute as a coherent whole. First, as discussed, the preceding subsection, AM, already dealt with sentence credit and explicitly incorporated the sentence credit statute. Second, the sentence immediately following the phrase entire period of time states that the parolee is not subject to mandatory release or presumptive mandatory release. This broader context shows that the phrase entire period of time is a restriction on early release, not on sentence credit. Legislative history confirms this plain meaning interpretation. The mandatory release statute was previously numbered 53.11. Subsection 7 was adopted in 1951. When first created, it did provide for early release for revoked parolees through good time. However, in Act 1983, Act 528, the legislature amended the statute to remove the possibility of automatic early release for revoked parolees. At the same time, this act created the language at issue in this case, entire period of time determined by the reviewing authority unless paroled earlier under paragraph C. The history of the statute confirms that subsection 7B is a restriction on early release, not sentence credit.
It seems to me that the Court of Appeals and the state are relying on, let's see if I get the numbers right, 302.11.7, and maybe even just B, and that you're relying on 973.155. Is that a good summary of the two arguments, or too simplistic, or?
No, I think that is, one thing about the Court of Appeals decision is it only mentions the sentence credit statute one time parenthetically. I think the focus was on the wrong statute at the lower courts, and that basic sentence credit principles apply even in this context.
And is it clear that had the sentence credit been applied at the early stage when it should have been applied, where would it have been applied? To the front end or the back end of the sentence?
Well, it would have backdated the prison sentence because subsection 3 of the sentence credit statute requires that the credit be computed as if the person had served the time in the correctional institution. There would have been no authority for the judge to withhold the credit for a speculative parole release date.
So if I understand your answer, had the credit been made at a timely basis when it should have been made, it would have reduced the confinement.
Correct.
And the argument is because it's now made later, it reduces the time of supervision.
Right.
And I'm going to pose that question to the state, too, as to how, if it was, it should have been credited to the prison term, the confinement, had it been done right. How can you say that you can change it at a later time when you're making a correction unless there's a good reason for changing it?
And I think that's where the misinterpretation of the mandatory release statute comes into play. If you isolate
mandatory release, you know, we haven't dealt with TIS for a long time. Mandatory release said after you serve X months percent of your sentence, you shall be released unless something else happens.
Right. It was,
is that right?
Yep. It was mandatory. It was automatic early release.
Right.
And the legislature specifically took that away from revoked parolees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what subsection 7B has to do with.
Your argument relies on, I guess, a plain meaning and also buttressed by legislative history, as you've just advanced, but you also have an argument regarding equal protection. What's the essence of that argument?
I think there are a few ways to look at it. One way I like to look at it is, as the Chief Justice mentioned, had the credit been recognized at the first opportunity, he would have served 107 days less in prison. Because there was a mistake that was outside of his control, he served 107 days more in prison than he would have otherwise. That's an arbitrary distinction. There's also a scenario where had Mr. Obright been able to post bond, some of the credit was for periods that he was under bond. If he was wealthier and could have posted bond, we wouldn't be in this situation. He wouldn't have served extra time in prison. Another topic I wanted to talk about is agency deference. It's true that sometimes this court defers to an agency's interpretation of a statute. However, it's only when the agency has been tasked with the statute and has special expertise in the area. When it comes to sentence credit, it's the courts that have the expertise and the courts that have been interpreting the statute since its inception. For that reason, I don't think the court owes any deference to the agency. But even if they did, the statute is clear and the agency is wrong.
Often the court says, you know what the effect is on your client. It's nothing. But what's the effect on other people that are still in prison in our, under the old law, the indeterminate sentencing law. Sometimes it's rephrased, are we going to open the floodgates of the prison? Or are we going to open floodgates for people coming back to the circuit court or this court seeking a change in their credit sentencing? So
I don't think a floodgates concern is that issue, because any inmate would have had the incentive to ask for their overdue credit already. Nobody's banking on their credit just in case the law changes to be more favorable. It's hard to tell how many people it will affect. Sentence credit mistakes do happen. It's not really possible to quantify them. But it's a big result for those people who are now serving more time in confinement than they would have had the credit been caught at the appropriate time.
The amicus brief, I remember it, says that the Department of Corrections gets or asks judges a lot of times, like 20 to 30 times a week, to correct sentence decisions. And that there were two people testifying from the Department of Corrections, and one testified that approximately 1 in 10 of the sentences that cross her desk are unlawful in some respect. And as a result, thousands of sentences have needed to be corrected. So do I have to worry about that? This all comes from Kaga v. Haley, if I look at the footnotes.
I believe the testimony was about the legal sentences. I don't know whether sentence credit errors fall within that gambit. I didn't take a close look at that testimony, so I'm not completely sure.
I mean, the punchline on the amicus brief is that because you have a lot of potential disputes about sentencing and credit, that it's important that the process for correcting errors in sentence and credit is fair and equitable and comports with the statutory mandates and constitutional principles. I mean, that's what the punchline is.
Right, and I think what got this case rolling in the first place shows that there's a need for guidance. Had it really been very clear what the agency's policy was, I'm not sure why the records office would have written to the judge for clarification. I'm not sure whether all institutions handle this issue the same way.
Mm-hmm.
There's no administrative rule on the topic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, therefore, that's another reason why this court should rule on the merits, even though the case is moot as to Mr. Albright.
From other cases that we've had, it struck me that the department has to write the judge because the credit in the sentence or in the conviction or in a sentencing order, and that the department can't change it by itself.
Right. And here there wouldn't have been any changes necessary to the judgment of conviction. There's simply a slot for credit. It said 107 days granted.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really nothing else that would have been listed on the judgment of conviction about that topic.
I understand.
I see my time is just about out, so I wanted to offer what I think should be the rule in this case. I believe where a prisoner is granted overdue sentence credit, the credit must be applied to the person's confinement time. It may not be withheld to shorten a future time of supervision. For these reasons, Mr. Obright respectfully asks the court to reverse the Court of Appeals. If other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, counsel, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Catherine Desmond Lloyd.
Excuse me. Good morning. May it please the court. The state requests that this court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, which held that Obright's custody credits must be applied to reduce his overall sentence exposure and not to reduce the sentence that was imposed by DHA in 2012 as a result of revocation.
Counselor, do you agree that when he was last sentenced, which I believe was in August of 2001, when probation was revoked and he got 7 years incarceration for count one, that if he had been given all the credit that he's asking for today, it would have been appropriate to apply it to the incarceration that was meted out at that time?
I think that the record's a lot unclear, but we've conceded, essentially, is that as long as that 107 days was spent in some sort of custody in connection with whatever led to revocation, then yes, it would have been appropriate to take it off of the confinement period.
Okay. And so now you're making a different argument just because the trial court kind of goofed up, aren't you?
Well, I think you're making the same argument that the custody credit comes off of whatever you're serving that custody in connection with this sentence. Now we have an intervening event in January of 2012 where we have a new sentence. He wasn't in custody in 1998, 99, and 2001 in connection with the 2012 sentence.
Run that by me again. I mean, I looked, he had 7 counts from the case, the 98, whatever the numbers are on that. Okay, from the 98 charging. He had 7 counts. He got time on either consecutive or concurrent on counts 2 through 7. On count 1, he got 12 years probation.
Correct.
Okay. And then a number of things happened. He was released on bail. Then he was put back in. Then he was tried. Then he was released pending appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was put back in again, okay, for the last time. After he was sent to Dodge County Correctional, which my notes say was April 21st, 2001, after that, he was revoked on count one. And my notes show it was August 17th, 2001. And then he was given 7 years consecutive to what he already had gotten on 2 through 7, right? So I think we are in agreement on the facts.
Yes.
All of the credit that he's asking for was for incarceration before he ever hit 8/17/2001, right? So all of that time is in connection with. Yeah? You agree with that?
I think so. I mean, okay. I agree that I think what you're saying is that if this had come to the court's attention in 2001, he would have gotten it off of his confinement time. Absolutely.
Okay, so he would have gotten it. So you're saying now because he was paroled and he was out on parole.
I'm saying once that parole was revoked,
yeah,
and before that revocation proceeding that determined the sentence, he's entitled to whatever time he spent in custody in connection with that revocation.
Okay.
He's not entitled to custody credit on time that he spent on a prior, relating to a prior sentence.
Well, because he's already out on parole, unless he gets sent back in, there's not going to be any incarceration to apply it to. Is that what you're essentially
yes,
saying?
Yes, and I think that that's where the equal protection problem fails, too, because if he hadn't been revoked, he wouldn't be entitled to get what he's seeking, which is off of confinement time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only because he was revoked that this has started up again. But I would say that that revocation started essentially a new sentence. And any time he spent in custody on whatever the 2012 ALJ decided, or before the ALJ made their determination, he's entitled to that, which I assume was in the revocation order, which I haven't seen, but counsel referenced in her brief. So I assume, you know, he got that credit. He's just not, our position is just that he's not, it's sort of a, you know, that ship has sailed, that sentence is over, that he Which gets to the problem with the definition, I think, of sentences, and it gets confusing.
Now, is that what the Court of Appeals said?
No, I think the Court of Appeals relied highly. I would say there's two bases to affirm the Court of Appeals, and one is just a basic, I agree with basic sentence credit calculation that it goes to the sentence that you're serving, but then there's also the 302.11.7b language, and to give import to that sentence that the parolee shall be incarcerated for the entire term as determined by DHA.
Where in your brief do you make the I'm trying to...
You're not going to find it because it just occurred to me yesterday.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm glad we cleared that up because I'm hearing a totally different argument, which is fine.
Well,
All the books say... Think it over again and try and come up with something creative and novel. And you're doing that in counsel. You're to be applauded.
Oh, well, thank
but
you.
I'm confused. Okay.
Yeah, well, and I apologize. I was going to start with, this might sound a little bit new, but just in thinking about it, especially last night, I just thought what the state's proposing is really, I think, a straight application of sentence credit, that you get credit for what you're in custody in connection with. And in this circumstance, I would say that previous 1998-99 isn't what he was in custody concerning in 2012.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I hear that, and I hear you then making, and this is meant to be complimentary, so once you do that, it's a standard argument that you cannot use confinement for this offense to reduce your confinement for that offense. And so my question is, again, because of the difficulties of keeping score on this, if that's your argument, then how do you get to 107 days?
I'm not sure.
Seems to me you'd have less days in confinement.
And that may be, but I think at this point the state conceded in the trial court that he was due 107 days. I don't know how that calculation was made. The record in this, at this point, despite the voluminous number of things that have happened, the record in this actual case is really thin. So I don't think I'm in a position to recalculate the number.
But for our court, we have to try and make sense and write an opinion that makes sense. So if you're going to make the argument about two different offenses or for which confinement is has been done, it seems to me then you'd have to tell me what the calculation is. And I think maybe the calculation is only 30 or so days.
I'm not sure I agree.
I don't know how I got that either, but it would sound like a good number to me.
I'm not sure that that's true, because since the case is moot, I think, as applies to Mr. Obright, I think you could write a general opinion that just says sentence credit is what we always think it is. You get custody. When you're in custody, you get credit against your sentence for time spent in connection with that conduct that led to that sentence. And I think it's just another application of Beats in all the other sentencing cases. I don't think it needs to be as complicated as perhaps we made it below.
Well, I don't know what the second offense is that we're talking about. Is it revocation?
Whatever led to the 2012 revocation.
So you are saying that the DOC revoked his parole because of something he did, and he gets sent back to prison, but there's no sentence by a judge on this conduct, or is there?
Not by a judge. Well, an ALJ. I think that reconfinement hearings have been held to be sentencings.
Okay. All right. So I think the question is, are they sentencing of the type that the statutes deal with, right? I mean, when I look at the statutes in question, I tend not to think about what you're saying, because he wouldn't have gone, I mean, I don't know what the charge was. Maybe it was disorderly conduct and he would have gotten jail time. But because he already had a felony conviction on which he had part of the 7 years certainly still available to serve, he got sent to prison, not to jail. So I without knowing what the charge is, and there's no conviction on the charge, you're saying that's a sentence
And therefore, there's no right to credit on that sentence.
Well, there would be right to credit on it if he were in custody, which he was in connection with that sentence.
Right, right, right.
I mean, I don't know how he'd get that custody if it weren't a sentence.
How does that fit? What section does that fit under 975-155 in your view?
973.
I think it's just 973-155. A convicted offender shall be given credit toward the service of his or her sentence for all days spent in custody.
But he isn't convicted. You mean he wasn't convicted by a court. You're saying that just his
But he's already been convicted. He was convicted back in...
No, but then you're tying it to what you're telling me it's not tied to, which is his 1998 conduct. All his other sentences that we're talking about are tied to the 1998 conduct.
Mm-hmm.
And the credit he would have gotten would have been tied to the 1998 conduct. Now you're telling me, well, when you look at subsection 1 of 973-155, he is convicted. Well, if you're relying on that conviction, then it's got to be in connection with. But you're telling me it's only in connection with the revocation of probation, and I'm having some problems with that because there's no conviction that causes the revocation of his probation.
But under that theory, then, in the 2001 revocation proceedings, he wouldn't have been entitled to the custody credit either if that wasn't a sentence. Right?
No. He had the credit before he was, well, he had the credit before he was ever paroled. He accumulated the credit before he was sentenced on August of 2001 for count one of the 1998 conduct. All the credit he's asking for, he accumulated before he got sentenced.
Right, but he's arguing that that should have been applied to that 2001 sentence. And if that revocation hearing isn't a sentence, under what you're posing, I don't understand how he gets it then.
He was sentenced by a court. He was convicted and sentenced by a court to 7 years incarceration.
Following revocation, but that's just before they changed it from DHA, right? That's just because we do it differently now.
Well, I don't know. 2009. I mean, I understand that's your argument. I'm not sure if
I think,
understand that.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Mike.
I think the distinction, and it's getting my interest, too.
Yeah.
I think the distinction that Justice Rogensack raises is the conduct which served as the basis for the revocation of parole supervision was not a conviction that occurred before a circuit court. It was an ALJ determination, right?
Yes.
Okay, so rather than a conviction, and I don't even know what the conduct was. Is it in the record?
I have not seen it in the record.
Okay. So whatever it was the triggering event. Rather, you know, I would say that's the triggering event, not a new conviction, but rather a triggering event for the revocation of parole supervision on the original sentence, and so therefore, the time that he's going to serve following the revocation runs back to the original conviction. Why isn't that correct?
I just don't think it is. I think that the revocation order and the sentence that follows that is a new event that's severed, just in many other cases, how they've determined that that's a new intervening event.
Well, before you get there, shouldn't you have a conviction from a court?
We do have a conviction from a court.
From a circuit court.
He's on parole. I mean, that's... and now.
Right,
now
but he hasn't been convicted of a new crime, as I understand.
Right, well, because I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was a crime that he did or if it was a violation.
Yeah, you never
None
know.
Of us
it
do.
Doesn't have to be. It could be staying out too late.
Yeah, and it, to me, to, I don't think our...
Or it could be a case that the prosecutor... It could be some heinous allegation that the prosecutor determines he or she can't prove beyond reasonable sure. doubt, but it can overcome the hurdle at a revocation here. And so, therefore, do you at least see my point as to the distinction? I'm not asking if you agree with me,
yeah.
But can you at least see the logic of the conduct which served as the basis for the revocation not being a new conviction, but rather a triggering event for the revocation of the parole supervision that was originally granted as part and parcel of the original sentence?
I'm having a hard time understanding it.
You're seeing that triggering event, that served as the basis for the revocation, as a break, as a separation, as a discontinuity between the original sentence and then the time he served after revocation. That's what I think I hear you say.
Maybe, but under your understanding,
To be clear, I'm asking. I'm not telling.
Yeah, but under the August 2001 revocation, that was before a judge because that was the law in 2001, right? Yes. So that, under your scenario, is treated differently than a revocation now?
Well, I get to ask the questions.
Okay.
And also, that's not the case in front of us. That's why should we be concerned? I'm not going to sit here and try to weigh out different hypotheticals. I want to know about the case we're hearing.
Right, but the August 2001 revocation, as I understand it, was because of the judge, because that's what the law was at the time, and now we're under a different 2009 rule where DHA makes these determinations. So I don't see why a sentence.
But what the judge imposed was in connection with the original sentence, the original conviction.
This isn't in connection with the sentence. I'm saying the custody that he was in 1999 isn't in. He wasn't in custody in connection with the 2012 sentence.
I understand your argument.
But you could not, under the record before us, there's nothing to show that that the appropriate sentence for what conduct occurred that violated the terms of probation was sufficient to send him to a prison.
No, I
he's
know.
Only in a prison because he's got the this original 1998 case on which he was revoked from probation in August in 2001. So if you didn't have that sitting there, you couldn't send him back. You couldn't send him to prison, correct?
Well, yes. Obviously, we can't send anyone to prison that isn't under a
conviction. Right, right. Absolutely. So because you can't send him to prison without it, I don't see how you get around opposing counsel's argument that that this is in connection with the conduct that occurred in 1998.
I think that the crimes are all connected as part of one judgment of conviction and whatnot, but I think that the different revocation orders, the different sentences that resulted from that, change things. When he was in 2001, that revocation order, he was in custody in connection with whatever conduct then led to that revocation.
He was already at Dodge Correction or something at that time.
Since his time on parole, he's reoffended in some way, and he's been revoked, and he's entitled to custody credit for whatever time he spent before that revocation, on hold for that revocation, for that specific revocation.
That's right, but I don't. Okay, well, I think we just see it maybe.
Could I
ask? It's confusing. Thank you.
It is confusing to me.
We don't know exactly why the defendant was revoked in 2011. Is that right?
I do not know why.
It is true, though, that people can be revoked for offenses that are not criminal.
Certainly.
And they can be sent to prison after revocation for offenses that are not criminal. How can that not be connected to the original offense?
It's obviously all connected. We wouldn't be here. He wouldn't have been revoked in 2012 were it not for his earlier behaviors. But the custody credit, I just think it's different. Just like we say, you know, you spend time in custody in connection with a course of conduct that led to that sentence. I would say that the earlier, decades ago, custody was not spent in custody, in connection with whatever happened in August 2011. Frankly, I don't see how it could be in connection with it because it hadn't happened yet.
But that's not the days of credit that he's asking for. The days of credit he's asking for all occurred by August 19th, 2001. Those are the days that we're looking at. They didn't occur after he was already out on parole. That's not what he's arguing.
No, I understand. But he was due that time at that revocation hearing, and that should have come off of that sentence from 2001 to reduce that term of imprisonment and hence his overall sentence. Yeah. But that's done. Then he's out. He reoffends. He goes back in custody. He's then entitled to whatever custody he spent in connection with whatever led to the revocation and the ultimate sentence.
But he's not asking. He got that.
I understand.
He's not grumbling about that. He's grumbling about what he should have gotten on his sentence.
I understand what he's grumbling about, and we just disagree as to the application of where that time goes.
Okay.
Counsel, thank you. There must be a reason that you are arguing this. And as I looked at your brief, this certainly 973-155 was virtually not analyzed at all. And now you're resting your hat, if that's what one rests, resting your hat on it. There must be a reason. Or do you want to argue what you advanced in your brief? Or do you think that's not of sufficient persuasion to advance that argument today?
I guess it's not that I don't think that it's persuasive. I just think that a simpler reading of the sentence credit makes this an easier case to resolve and understand and put in the world of sentence credit instead of making it sort of an outlier, an anomaly, and relying on this subsection. I think this subsection 7B of 302.11 isn't inconsistent with my position now, and I think that I still think it's a legitimate reading of that subsection, that it means that the DHA determination of sentence is the sentence that he's must be incarcerated for.
Do you have any legislative history that supports that? Your opposing counsel backs up the interpretation with legislative history. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think her legislative history, I don't dispute her legislative history, and I think that, but I don't know that it changes our position. I don't think her position undermines our position. I mean, I realize she disagrees with it, but I don't think the legislative history undermines it, which is just that, and I think actually the second sentence about that the parolee is not subject to MR, maybe underscores our argument too, that a DHA determination of sentence isn't to be altered.
Counsel, having written at least one sentence credit case and remember struggling with the calculation and with the statutes, recognizing how difficult it is to draft a good sentence credit statute because you have such diverse fact situations. Why shouldn't the rule be where the appropriate credit, which everybody agrees here, where the appropriate credit was not made earlier, but is and should have been, but is made later and is still valid, can still make it. Why shouldn't the rule be give them credit for whatever would have been appropriate at the earlier stage when it should have been done? And then what you have left over is any confinement after that time, and then we'll have to deal with it. So why isn't that a good, simple rule? And as I understood your argument, had this been done, had the credit been done earlier, he would have been entitled to 107 days. Maybe even a little less, but we're not going to fight about that. Why isn't that a simple, good rule and fair? Fair to the state, fair to the defendant. Hey, you made a mistake, go back and fix it as if you can fix it in the past. And we could here.
Well, we can't hear, but...
Well, because he happens right to be out, but it theoretically is fixable now.
Yes. I don't disagree that that wouldn't be a fair rule. I just don't think that is the rule. I mean, the statute says in connection with, and so presumably that changes things. But I think that's a legislative argument. I don't see anything unfair about it.
I understand. Thank you.
One other wrinkle in this case is that the judge, when his probation was revoked in 2001, granted 107 days of credit. That's what the record shows me. But it wasn't until 2013 the DOC wrote and said, oh, no, you're calculating that wrong.
No, I think that's misreading. That's an amended judgment of conviction that you're looking at?
I am looking at the judgment of conviction, right, for count number one, sentence date 8/17/2001. It's when he gets 7 years consecutive to other sentences issued earlier. And he gets court orders 107 days credit.
Right, but that's dated February 2013. That was amended when he came back pro se and petitioned the circuit court for the 107 days?
Yeah.
So that didn't occur until 2013.
Okay, gotcha.
And then DOC received, I assume, that judgment of conviction, which prompted the letter.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, if there are no other questions, I'll just sit down. Thank you.
Well, let's check it out. Any other questions? None. Thank you very much, counsel. Attorney Marion.
I want to point out one statute that could help clarify whether reincarceration term can properly be called a sentence. There's one really helpful statute that I'm going to find here. Okay, so I'm not finding it, but there's a statute that explains that upon revocation, the sentence of a revoked parolee or somebody on ES resumes running. So I think that language satisfies the question of whether reincarceration time is a new sentence. I think the answer is no. It's simply that the original sentence is resuming running. Another issue I had with that argument is the idea that there's one thing that causes a revocation. When people are on supervision, it's a kind of a continuing dialogue between them and their supervising agent. We do know in this case from the DOC letter that he did have some credit from holds during his parole period that were credited to his reincarceration time. Those holds would have been from different infractions, and yet they were credited to his reincarceration time. I think a decision by this court would have to deal with the mandatory release statute, but I think it could be brief. I think really the correct result in this case comes from the basic sentence principles from 973.155.
Counselor, when you said there's a statute that you think is helpful in determining the nature of or definition of sentence, if you look at 302.11, paren am, it says that you can return the parolee to prison for a period up to the remainder of the sentence for a violation of the conditions of parole. And she's saying that sentence means whatever time they give him back in. Are you saying that word sentence there means what he was initially ordered to serve?
I am, and I also located the other statute I was looking
for. Okay, good, thank you.
Which is 304.072(4).
304.072(4).
Correct.
Okay, the sentence of a revoked parolee or person on extended supervision
resumes running.
Okay, the day or he is received at the correctional institution. Oh, that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Thank you, Ms. Marion, and thank you, Ms. Lloyd, for your arguments on yet another sentence credit case. We'll consider your arguments as well as your briefs carefully. And that ends our hearing in 13AP 1345 CR State versus Obright. The court will take a few minutes recess so that the Edgewood High School students can enter. Are they here? Okay. We're in recess for a few moments.